Welcome to the Unfit Podcast. Hello and welcome to the Unfit Podcast, a weekly discussion on key trends in investment and economic policy from some of the world's leading commentators. I'm Emma McGarthy, head of Unfit Sustainable Policy Institute, and today we will be discussing policies and strategies surrounding Germany's renewable energy development. I'm delighted to be joined today by Philipp Steinberg, who is the Director General for Economic Policy in the German Federal Ministry for Economic Affairs and Energy, and is Coordinator for Sustainable Development as well. So thank you so much for joining me today. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Emma. It's a pleasure for me as well.
Lovely. So let's dive in. My first question to you is, obviously, to achieve net zero and mitigate climate change, it's clear we must transition from fossil fuel intensive energy pathways, yet progress on this remains slow. Germany obviously aims to be carbon neutral by 2050 and has now adopted a strategy for an energy pathway to 2050. So could you talk me through the strategy and the policies that have been adopted to enable this? What regulatory and structural reforms will be required?
Yes, of course, with great pleasure. Actually, I mean, we have even toughened our goal once again. So we aim at climate neutrality by 2045 already. So it's an even a bit quicker. And this is, of course, amazingly ambitious. So how do you want to achieve that, those goals? I mean, first we have, this is quite important for us. We are very fond of our concept, as you know, of social market economy. But now we're transforming it into an ecological social market economy. That means actually we put much more emphasis on actually integrating the rights of the future generations into our behavior already today. And that means we are kind of mainstreaming climate policy in all policy areas. So this is maybe on the macro level what we are doing. What is then the plan to achieve climate neutrality by 2045? Well, first we have regulatory instruments we need to use in order to attain those goals. And that is first and foremost, of course, it's CO2 pricing on the national and the European level, which is, let's say, the main instrument we are using in Germany, but we would like to bring it on the international scene as well. So we are campaigning for a climate club. So an alliance of states actually who have the same goal, ideally the same instruments, but not necessarily so. And then we need something, obviously what we call a carbon border adjustment mechanism in order to protect this climate club. And because if we use CO2 pricing as a signal and we want to maintain our industry, then obviously we need to kind of put some kind of tariff or some kind of mechanism at the border in order to create a level playing field. So basically, this is regulatory instruments. There are others come along. Of course, procurement is very important. Competition policy is important. Also, like the standard regulatory standards. So first pillar, regulatory instruments with our main instrument as the CO2 price or market-based instrument. Then second, what we need, of course, is support instruments, because at least as long as the price is not the main signal, because it's not high enough, we need to, of course, help especially the industry to do this transformation, to help the industry transform into this carbon neutral state. So we are developing support instruments like carbon contracts for difference, where we actually subsidize industry and for the surcharge of the price of producing climate friendly. And we have other support programs. And then third, of course, this needs to be financed. And therefore we are providing adequate financing in a special fund It's the Climate and Transformation Fund, which is actually financing those support programs. So basically, this is our let's say, three-pillar plan, regulatory instruments, support instruments, then financing. And of course, let me add to close, of course, this needs to be accompanied by, of course, social and economic complementary measures. That means, of course, we need to actually make sure that the ordinary citizen actually gets support as well in order to be able to bear the cost of CO2 pricing and actually for him or her actually to get motivation and incentives and to change his or her behavior as well.
Yeah, no, fantastic. And really lovely to hear that the time frame has been adjusted to 2045. I think that's brilliant. So obviously we touched upon many things there. And you talked about a key regulatory instrument being carbon pricing. So from what I've seen, a key initiative Germany has taken is implementing, I believe, a 25-euro charge on carbon emissions. So what impact has this had, and how will the money raised from this kind of be used? Will it go into the funding that you mentioned to drive carbon neutral?
Well, I mean, actually, yeah, we started with that's our national CO2 pricing mechanism. It's a very beautiful German word for all of you who speak German or understand German. It's the Brennstoffemissionshandelsgesetz. You know, it's a beautiful German term. And we now it's 30 euros. We started off with that with 25 euros. We are increasing it every year up to a threshold of 60 euros. So basically, it's not totally free floating. It's supposed to be, of course, to have an effect on citizens, which is now, of course, much more, let's say, accelerated by the price developments we are seeing because of the Ukraine war. But still, I mean, it's basically, as things stand, it's approximately 8 billion euros. So what we get from the CO2 price, the national CO2 price, so 8 billion euros, that's money, of course, but it's not, you cannot do the whole transformation with it. But the main action that we are taking now is to abolish like the renewable energy surcharge. You might know that with our renewable energy law dating back from the beginning of the 2000s, we actually encourage renewables. We paid a fixed price for everybody who builds a renewable energy plant. And that was a good instrument. It was highly successful. But of course, now it is, approximately 4 eurocents the kilowatt hour. And of course, that makes it more expensive to use electricity. And we need electricity because, of course, in order to decarbonize the economy, we need to use, of course, green electrical energy. And therefore, we need to make it cheaper. Otherwise, industry wants to circumvent it. So that's one measure. But of course, we are using the money coming from this CO2 price signal as well for other measures aiming at the transformation of the economy.
Brilliant. There are also, to kind of reach the targets that you've set, there are plans to shut down all lignite and heavy coal power plants by I believe 2038. So how will this be managed, especially considering Germany's car industry, which is obviously huge and employs kind of over 2 million workers?
We are even having adjusted these targets once again. So like our target, as things stand, things might change a little bit because of the Ukraine war once again, but we want to phase out lignite and heavy coal by 2030 already. So this is quite once again ambitious, and we are what are we doing? How are we doing it? We are we have set up a 40 billion euro support program. I'm actually responsible for, in order to help the regions affected to act to find alternative economic uses. And we are actually phasing out until, as we said, now it used to be 38, now it's 2030. And we have basically come up with a plan how to phase out lignite. So basically it's up to 2038. We have really determined in a quite a, let's say, bureaucratic way in negotiations with the companies, the lignite companies, actually when to take out plants with heavy coal and black coal. It's a bit different. There we have auction mechanisms. We have actually established market-based auction and mechanisms. So basically, it's a more market-driven instrument how to take out those plants. Basically, we ask so how much do we have to pay in order for you to take out a heavy coal plant? But then we help the regions affected, and that's important. You know, we have set up like a commission. We had a commission proposing measures and how to actually alleviate the consequences, how to actually speed up the transformation from a coal-based industry in those regions towards a green industry and other measures. So it's a 40 billion euros program, which we are transposing at this very, very moment.
Mm. And how do you think that will be received by the workers in the industry and that kind of transition? How do you think that will be? Yeah, how do you think that will be received kind of in the wider industry?
Well, I mean, obviously there is, of course, there are concerns, of course, mm-hmm. with the workers and in the regions, because, of course, those coal plants, I mean, those were industry jobs, well-paid industry jobs. And therefore, obviously, they're concerned that they're replaced with less well-paid service or other jobs. So yes, we have to do something in order to stimulate new industry to come into the regions. And I think we can say we are quite successful. You know that Intel is building a new plant next to Magdeburg. Tesla, this is not a coal region, but still it's quite near, close to a coal region. We are inducing and we are supporting like research, R&D businesses and R&D, the research institutions in the regions, because we know that actually this is very important to have qualified labor force in the regions, because in spite of that, those regions tend to be structurally weaker. There's a shortage of skilled labor. So we need to actually attract the skilled labor. And I mean, you know, the current industry you're alluding to, they are not directly concerned by the coal phasing out. It's really more those directly working in the coal industry and in related companies who are actually service companies or other companies supporting the lignite and coal businesses.
Mm, no, that sounds really, really fantastic. I'd like to move now kind of maybe more into the wider EU framework. And I know there's been a lot of conversation around the EU taxonomy and Germany's kind of role within this. So obviously the EU's taxonomy has awarded a green label to gas and nuclear power. And the German government has generally opposed electricity which is generated under nuclear energy as unsustainable. So could you talk me through this and what this means for the EU taxonomy and its implementation?
Yeah, well, obviously, I mean, you know that there is of course a huge controversy about is nuclear power green or isn't it green? And well, the debate has been going on for a decade now, or much more than a decade, actually, many decades. And the German position is upheld by this government, especially also my, I'm, you know, I'm the working for a green minister, Robert Habeck and his crew. And they are of the opinion that, and this is, I think, the main concern for Germany, of course, that, first of course, it's dangerous, as we can see again and again, Fukushima, Harrisburg, Chernobyl, are examples of that. And second, of course, that the waste question is still not answered. You know, of course, I know in Finland, they're building depositories for nuclear waste. In Germany, even those who are advocating nuclear power, they all say, oh, no, not at my region. So, and obviously we know that this is millions of years. Yes, it's CO2 free, or it's not free, but it's relatively low CO2 emission. But we are, obviously there. We have to do actually with the balancing, and the balancing in Germany is that the negative aspects are outweigh the positive effects. And then, of course, there is gas as a bridge technology for Germany. Obviously, you know, in Germany, the problem here is we are phasing out lignite and coal, as I have explained, and with all the consequences for energy security and for the 50,000 people employed in these industries. Then we are phasing out nuclear, and actually nuclear by this year. We have three nuclear power plants still operating. And by the end of this year, if things don't change because of Ukraine, then we need some energy. We have renewables in the electricity sector. It's already like over 40% renewables. Mm-hmm. Still, obviously, we are not there yet. And so we need flexible energy sources. And as things stand, that needs to be gas especially. And we know it's not sustainable. We all know that. But it's a bridge technology, and we would have liked the EU to come up with a bridge legislative act, actually clearly flagging that gas and possibly nuclear are bridge technologies, but the Commission didn't follow. So yes, I mean, it's not, you know, it's we are not saying gas is sustainable. We are certainly saying nuclear is not sustainable. And I have difficulty seeing, you know, we're talking about the green bond standard at the EU level, as you are, I'm sure all of our listeners will be aware. And there, of course, there are cross references to the taxonomy. And I have difficulties actually thinking, yes, I understand that they might have difficulties considering gas as sustainable, but it's only for a limited time. That is important. And the plants have to be H2 ready, so they have to be hydrogen ready. So you know, it's not that we are actually having those lock-in effects, which are really quite problematic. But I have problems thinking that the investors will be happy actually to buy nuclear bonds, you know, and thinking they are sustainable, you know. So yes, it's not totally logical in everything, but that's a little bit due to the complicated nature of this act, and of course of our double phasing out of nuclear and coal.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really excellent point, and I think maybe one of the concerns with nuclear as well, and obviously what's happened with fossil fuels, is that it is lock in. So once you start using it, it's incredibly difficult to phase out. What are your thoughts of nuclear energy in terms of being able to phase out of nuclear energy? Do you think there is that potential if you develop a nuclear energy that you are then going to be locked into that source for, say, the coming decades?
In Germany, nuclear energy, I mean, our experts say at least it would be really, I mean, they have planned for years and years to actually phase them out. They don't have the trained personnel anymore. They don't have the necessary combustion material anymore. And second, then of course, if you restart building plants, I mean, if you look at the price, I mean, now we in Germany, we have our tender procedures for renewables, like we have prices below 5 cents per kilowatt hour, according to different sources, like the price per kilowatt hour, even if you don't take into consideration that you really need to have, I mean, you don't find any insurance who will insure a nuclear power plant. It must be the state. even if you don't consider this, then the kilowatt hour is much more expensive nuclear than renewables. And look at what they, Hinkley Point in Great Britain or so on. They are basically, they have a guaranteed price. It must be, I think it's 90 pounds per megawatt hour. I'm not totally sure if this is correct, but it's a guaranteed price. Otherwise, there will be a subsidy. And that shows that nuclear is not economical anymore. This is really beyond all those questions of what is sustainable. I mean, there is no business case for nuclear anymore if there is not massive subsidy from the state.
Yeah, no, I think those are really, really excellent, excellent points. You also touched upon kind of gas being a bridge and obviously connected to this conversation. There is an acceptance of the inclusion of gas in the EU taxonomy by the German government, as you said, as it can bridge the transition to coal. So I think you touched upon this a little bit already, but just to go a bit deeper. So how will gas-fired power plants kind of support the transition to renewable energy and the reduction of CO2? And is there a risk that by doing this, it could supplant the increased development and capital allocation towards renewable energy sources?
Yeah, this is what I already hinted at. I mean, we have obviously what is very important that, and we have actually included that in the taxonomy proposals. You know that now we have the deadline is still up to come. We have to decide. The member states have to decide if they will object to the proposal. We haven't made up our mind yet now if what will be our behavior. But what is quite clear that, of course, new gas plants, gas-fired plants, have to be hydrogen ready. So there is, and this green hydrogen will be increasingly phased into those gas-fired plants. So basically, there is not a lock-in effect with natural gas, but there can be a gradual transition towards a green hydrogen. And of course, we need then balancing process. We need to use electricity storage, demand flexibility, and highly interconnected market exploring different renewable energy sources across Europe. So basically, we are not happy, and obviously that we need to use gas as a bridge technology. And now, because of the aggression against Ukraine, obviously we are like accelerating, of course, our depart from gas as much as possible. So we're increasing renewables and we are decreasing our dependency on gas. But you know that Germany used to be dependent by 55% of our natural gas came from Russia. So it's a bit difficult to diversify like from one day to the next. But to sum up, we are not happy with the gas-fired plants, but still, if we make them hydrogen-ready, then we can transition from natural gas to green hydrogen, and then there's no lock-in effect, and then that's actually ecologically viable.
Again, excellent points. Just going back to subsidization, I think this is something that's quite interesting. Obviously, one of the issues that I see in terms of kind of the continued development of fossil fuel energy is the fact that governments are still subsidizing the use and kind of the development of that. Obviously, you've mentioned that kind of the German government is now subsidizing renewable energy in a really big way, and that's fantastic to hear. But what's the stance on kind of continued subsidization on fossil fuels? Is that happening? Is there kind of being a divestment from that? Kind of what's the general stance and a movement?
Well, I mean, this is complicated.
It's a complicated topic.
Because on the one hand, as I have explained, we are campaigning and for a CO2 price signal, for a CO2 tax or instrument. What we have introduced on the national level and of course in the EU, you still remember, you know, anywhere in the EU, there's an emission trading system as well, which is actually relevant for industry. And therefore, actually, we want to make it more expensive, like trivial to say, in order to use alternative energy sources. On the other hand, of course, we have two developments, which are, of course, actually reinforcing each other. First, we had Corona, the Corona crisis, the COVID crisis, with a dislocation of the international value chains and distribution channels, actually. And this has created huge turmoil and, of course, an increase of energy prices. So we all talk about fossil inflation. And I think this was totally right, because those international value change and the channels through which fossil energy was channeled were just disrupted. And on the other hand, now we have the Ukraine war, which of course now is creating even more shortages of fossil energy. We want to phase out, but we are still dependent on. So obviously this creates inflation of 7% or more, and it creates higher prices of not only gas and fossil, so heating for households and the gas for industry, but also higher prices for bread and other of course basic goods, and therefore of course there's pressure for governments and in Germany as well. We couldn't actually withstand it to at least for a temporary time. Now we are reducing our energy tax on fuel. So this actually is not totally consistent, you know, with a price signal approach. On the other hand, I mean, this dual crisis, Corona, and on top of that, Ukraine is just, of course, I mean, the prices are soaring, and this is, of course, for every politician, this is very hard to handle, and it's only temporary. So basically, and it's clear in our coalition treaty as well, we want to get rid of subsidies, which run against the climate protection, and go, if you need support, of course, we do need support. We are a social market economy, an ecological social market economy. We need direct support, of course, of citizens, but not subsidization of fossil fuels. But yes, once again, it's not a totally coherent approach right now, but due to the crisis and we are living in a democracy. So, there's different interests.
So obviously we touched upon Ukraine a couple of times during the conversation. So again, just to dive slightly deeper into that, and I appreciate it's a challenging question to answer, but kind of how do you think the current geopolitical crisis will impact Germany's renewable energy transition? We talked about the shutting of the coal plants. Will this have an impact on that? And do you think it will kind of have an impact in terms of Germany's current energy mix and, yeah, kind of the current targets and the way that renewable energy is being developed and transitioning?
Well, I mean, in the mid and in the long run, it will accelerate our transition towards renewables dramatically. That is quite clear. And just today, I mean, today we are, for the listeners, it's the 6th of April. We have just passed a law in our cabinet, which actually provides for massive speeding up of renewables. We have designated areas, 2% of our land for renewables. We are speeding up planning procedures. We have made clear that renewables are of overriding public interests. So basically, planning procedures don't have to do the complicated, you know, on the one hand, there are birds and other interests. On the other hand, there's the interest of to have renewables, but there's a clear priority for renewables. And we have, of course, raised our targets substantively for wind turbines on land, for offshore, onshore, photovoltaic and so on. So this will be accelerated, because obviously if you have learned one thing from Ukraine is you need to diversify, become less dependent in the very short run. However, now, of course, now we are, it might actually make it a bit more difficult because obviously we are, now we are talking about LNG and other, and we are even talking about running the coal plants longer than expected. Maybe we will, as I've said, it's not decided yet, but at least there's public debate about that. So it might mean in order to reduce dependency from Russia, we might need to, in order to diversify, we might need to use for like by limited time also like energy sources like LNG coming from fracking in the United States or elsewhere we wouldn't have considered before the crisis. And this is, of course, nothing to reduce CO2 emissions, but let's say in the mid and longer term, it will really accelerate renewables. And it shows that our political goal was totally correct. And it's, you know, that energy transition is not only if you can say that. I mean, you know, we all know the urgency of climate change and how hard it is to achieve the 1.5 or even the 2 degree target and how important it is. But if this is not enough, then you can say it's a geostrategic or geopolitical necessity to actually transition towards renewables. And therefore, the Ukraine war will actually help us with our Energiewende, because it's not only some people say, oh, we're only talking about climate, but it's also of strategic importance for Germany and Europe.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if there's one thing that the Ukraine crisis has also shown is that action can be taken very rapidly by the international community when it's needed. And we just need that urgency of climate to be shown so that action can be taken. Thank you so much, Philip. Is there any final thoughts or final takeaways that you would like our listeners to go away with?
Well, I mean, I think the combined crisis of Corona and Ukraine and the climate emergency actually show the need to work together collectively, because those are all common goods, peace, reduction of externalities, of course. So we can only succeed if we work together. And as you have said, exactly, the Ukraine war shows that it's possible, and it would be really great if we could find this feeling of urgency as well concerning the climate crisis. And it's not that, you know, we cannot afford to talk about climate policies because of the Ukraine war, but it's because of the Ukraine war we need to actually talk about it even with more urgency, because the Ukraine war shows that the way we have produced energy, and of course we have maybe not respected our security necessities the right way collectively, means we need to think it together and bring it together.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Brilliant. Well, look, thank you so much for joining me today, Philip, and sharing your invaluable insight. And thank you to our listeners. You can subscribe to this and all other OnFit podcasts on our channel on Spotify and iTunes. Thanks again, Philip.
Yeah, thank you so much, Emma. It was a pleasure. And have a good afternoon.
Thank you for listening to the OnFit podcast.